Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning, Henry. Thank you. You're awake then. Fantastic. Welcome to the second day of the Members' Weekender. And for getting up so early, I'm really impressed. I've heard that some people were up actually past 10:30 last night, so I'm a little bit surprised that there's so many of you here this morning. But congratulations, well done, and fantastic that you're all here. Hope you enjoy today as much as we all enjoyed yesterday. A quick bit of housekeeping, just to make sure that all pagers and mobile phones are switched off, because if they ring, Mike will take the mickey out of you, and I might join in as well. And if you hear the fire alarm today, it's not a drill. Follow the signs for the exits, and you'll be guided as to where to go. I think some exits over here. I'm sure there'll be some stuff around to help you. Just a quick to let you know what's going to happen during Mike's presentation this morning. I think it's designed to be very interactive. So if you've got questions for Mike, raise your hand. And there are some roving microphones, I believe. So someone's holding a Simon and A up there. I'm not quite sure. Is that a mark for my speech, is it? Good. And if you can just wait to answer your question, wait before until the microphone gets to you so that we can all hear what the question is, and then we'll all know what Mike's talking about then, won't we? Okay.
No guarantee, Anna.
Well, no, fair enough, fair enough. Okay, moving on then. I think it's, just without any further ado then, just like to introduce our first speaker this morning. I think for most of us, Mike doesn't really need any introduction. But for those of you that haven't met Mike before, this is Michael Steed. He's a well-known tax presenter and familiar to many of you, as I say, I'm sure. He has a special interest in SME tax issues and advises on them on a regular basis. Michael also sits on the Council of ATT. And is a member of the Tax Technical Committee. Now, I don't know if he was joking on it when we started, but he did actually say that he wants lots of heckling. So he did say that to me. I've passed that on. Whether he is joking or not, I don't know. But, you know... Thank you, Jeremy. I knew one of you would help me out here.
There's always one.
Yes, right.
There's always one, Henry.
Okay, without any further ado, then, it says Henry leaves lectern and heads to reserve table. So I'm going to do just that and hand over to
Henry
Mike.
Henry leaves.
Thank
right.
you, Mike.
Okay, thank you. Right. Can you hear me at the back okay? Can you hear me glugging my water?
Hello?
Right, now who's holding the roving mic? Irena, that's fantastic. Okay, that's good. All right, well, very warm welcome to you. Remember the format of this session is that I don't actually produce any slides for it. Very happy that if you want some of the information that comes out of this session, I'll email it to you afterwards, that's no problem, or I'll put it up on the website or some way that you can easily access it. But the point of this one is that it's a genuine clinic, and the reason I'm holding this great clutch of kit here is because I've been emailed stuff over the last two or three days and texted, and the last two came in literally at 8:30 this morning. So it's not as though I've had an awful lot of time to actually prepare for this. So it's genuinely free form. So that's why there's no slides. But the issue for us is very simple, that I'm going to take some of these questions that have been raised by members covering quite a wide range of topics. I don't know how many we've got time for, but I've got about seven here that have come in, seven groups of them, and I'm going to selectively pick out of those just so that we're clear about what's going on. So very much a kind of a free format. As Henry said, I encourage your questions, encourage you to talk to me. and I'm just going to read them out, as it were, sketch them, and then we're going to have a play with them. Someone's just handed me this one here. I love this one. This is an England and Wales Court of Appeal criminal division decision about someone who's nicked some money from the Crown cheating. And the bloke is called Gareth Edward Steed. So, so thanks for that, mate. Thank you very much for that. Yeah, I have to say, not one of ours. Right, okay, so away with Gareth Edward Steed. Let's get the first one up then. Let's just have a play with this. This is somebody, and I'll just give you a sense of this. I just want to check this is all working. Yes, it is. That's great. A sense of this one here. I've got a client who has land and buildings. It's about 0.8 acres. We've got a house, which is his PPR. We've got a workshop, and we've got a bothy cottage. A holiday let at the far end of the gardens, all in all, sold for just under £1 million. So the question is, what's all that for CGT? So let's just actually, let's just sketch that out, as it were. So we've got a sales price of 995k. And I'll sketch the elements here. What we've got is we've got a house. That's his house there. He's also got his yard plus workshop. And the workshop was used for his trade. So if I just put there used in his trade, and we've got his holiday cottage. Right, now what he hasn't given me is the purchase price on that, so we can't immediately imagine the gain. But let's just say that we've got a gain of 700,000 on there, just very round numbers there. We'll work with that as a kind of a number. So the question is then, if we've got a gain of 700,000, how much of it will actually be charged? How will we go about doing that? What's the key word that comes to mind here when we've got a gain that covers a number of issues here? It's all being sold, it's one unit. Can we actually carve it up? What's your instinct? Apportionment? Some kind of apportionment? I think some kind of apportionment too. Remember, apportionment is done on a kind of an aerial basis like this, but it can also be done on a time basis. You know, we'll come on to that because this is my second question, is about buy-to-lets. Now, what about the house element of that? I mean, we haven't talked about how we're going to carve it up, and that's, I think, beyond the scope of what we're trying to do. But what's the CGT treatment of this house? No CGT?
No.
Be more precise.
No,
it's exempt, isn't it? Why is it exempt? Because it's his principal private residence. Yeah, absolutely. Remember, all of that comes out of the TCGA, that's the Taxation of Chargeable Gains Act, 1992. And there's a very tiny bit of legislation around about section 226. And it's what I think of as being balsamic vinegar intense. You know, it's incredibly short. And opening up behind that very short bit of legislation is a great raft of IR interpretations. They still call them interpretations, about sort of two houses in the garden, all the rest of it. So if you need to go into PPR, there's a very tiny bit of ledge, but a huge raft of kit actually out behind it. But I agree, in the absence of anything else, I think that's covered by his principal private residence relief, and it's going to be exempt. What about the yard and the workshop, which is used by him for his trade and never let? And I quote there absolutely from this text.
Is he ceasing the trade, Mike?
Is he ceasing the trade? Yes, he is, absolutely, Bob. He's selling up. He's retiring. So the information I have here is that he is retiring.
Could be ER.
Could be ER? Do you agree?
Yeah.
Do you get the point of that one? That will be chargeable to CGT. That is chargeable. But the point is that we've got the strong possibility of entrepreneur's relief. Do you agree that entrepreneur's relief is available both in corporate and also in unincorporated formats? So if this guy is genuinely retiring or giving up in some way, shape or form, then do you agree we've got a strong likelihood of ER? Yeah? Tim?
Would it still qualify for ER, even if
we
just sold the whole thing as a whole and people weren't buying his business, just buying it as a residence, even though he was running it as a business, because he's not actually then selling...
No, he's not selling a business, no, but he is actually retiring from it.
So it's a disposal.
I think it's a disposal, because the key word for CGT is that it's a disposal. And I think that's a very well-made point. I mean, you know, I'm just kind of sketching this up here, and I would actually press that a little bit more. But I think the issue is that there's a possibility that that one will qualify for entrepreneur's relief. But we'd have to dig. So if I just put there, dig, which means I'm looking for more information just here. It's a technical word, that, dig. It just means find out lots of other exciting things. What about the holiday cottage? What are the tax issues in respect to the holiday cottage? What do you reckon? Do you reckon is that going to be fully chargeable to CGT? He's running that, Bob, as a holiday cottage. No, he's never lived in that. He's always had the house. It came with the Bothy cottage. And he's just rented that out on a seasonal basis. So what area of tax immediately comes up there? Furnished holiday lets, absolutely. So the issue really is it a furnished holiday let? Now, if it is a furnished holiday let, and let's just take a very simple example here, that it actually qualified for furnished holiday let status all the way through the ownership. In other words, it was in a good position and he was able to rent it out every year. What would be the CGT? Assuming that it qualifies, let's just put that down here. Assume qualifies for furnished holiday let. What are the implications of that when we sell it, you know, as part of this big game? We're selling a furnished holiday let at a gain. Gets ER. Thank you, Derek. Absolutely. That's a very important point there, that although it's property, it's a property business, because it's a furnished holiday let. Do you remember the point about furnished holiday lets, folks, is that it actually brings it into trading, and that's massively important. So that's a good result on that. Thanks, Derek. That's absolutely right. So we'll put a smiley face up there. just effectively to remind us that we will have that. But what about if it didn't qualify every year? And do you agree with me, ladies and gents, that having a furnished holiday let, you've got to satisfy all the conditions in every year, basically, for it to be a furnished holiday let? The rules have changed very slightly, such that if you get a bad year now, you can frank that with a good year. But I don't want to go into that level of complication on this particular sketch. I'm just asking the general question. If the furnished holiday let has not been a furnished holiday let each year, in other words, some years he didn't qualify for it, what's the CGT result of that? Not all of it, but it's an apportionment. So if you had this part here, if you were to take the holiday cottage and that's the time over which it was owned, and let's just say it's yes there, but it's no there, and just say that these are years, and yes, and then no, and no, because we had two bad summers, and then yes, and yes. So all those are the, just say, the number of years that he kept it for. In those circumstances, you simply do another sub-apportionment. You simply say that all these years he qualified where we've got the ticks, but in the years that we've got the crosses, he didn't qualify, and therefore that won't be furnished holiday let, and therefore won't qualify for the entrepreneur's relief in that sub-period. So can you take the point here that you've got to think carefully about the numbers and the dates and the qualification on the furnished holiday let in order to arrive at whether it's... Both. If you actually go into the furnished holiday let rules, there are two levels of qualification. The first is the availability test. That's number one. It's got to be available for a certain number of days. And there's an and in there, it's got to be actually let for another number of days. And in 2012, if I could just give you an update point, those numbers have increased by 50%. So what it means is that it's now much harder from 2012 to be a furnished holiday let, and a lot more marginal properties will simply fall out of account, and therefore we're going to get more of this type of thing, where you get more crosses than you would get ticks. So the world's not moving in favour of furnished holiday lets, but they're obviously very important. Remember, again, update point, there are 2 years of change, 2011 and 2012. The rules on sideways loss relief and all that kind of good stuff that really made these very attractive went last year, that's 2011, and the rules on availability and the number of days let increased by 50%. That's just gone up in 2012. Back to either the acquisition or 1982. Yeah, it's one of those kind of weirdy rules in there. But basically now you forget anything before 1982. That went out a couple of years ago. Right, is that okay, folks? That's the first of the sketches coming up. Oh, Irena.
Hello. Can you hear? Hello.
Hello.
All right, sorry, I'm Karen.
Hello.
If the yard was within the curtilage of the house... Could you say that was exempt as well?
That's a nice idea. Actually, yes, that would be two bites of the cherry, and I like that one. If you could actually, supposing you didn't qualify on ER, well, actually, no, I'll tell you what, you're right. My first, having thought about that for 30 seconds, I think you'd try and see whether it was in the curtilage. But do you take the point that, I mean, the total size of this is 0.8 acres, and the curtilage is always, remember, the ground you need for the effective enjoyment of the property.
I suppose the other thing I was thinking of is if it had been like a farmhouse, and therefore with farmhouses, your curtilage tends to be...
It tends to be bigger, I agree. But this is only 0.8 acres.
Okay.
If it was a big farmhouse, I agree, or a big house, then as you'd expect, the curtilage would increase in proportion. But remember, the curtilage is that weird word. It just means the land you need for the effective enjoyment of that house. So the curtilage for Woburn Abbey would be 200 acres of Capability Brown Parkland. The curtilage of 22 railway cuttings Cheam would be just the garden. So, yeah, that's a fair point. In fact, it just shows you how much that you need to think about these as you're going along. But, yes, if I could get it under the curtilage, I think I would prefer that, because obviously that would exempt the entire gain as opposed to not. Brian Coe, did you have a question there? Or?
I I think it's the enjoyment is the aspect, isn't it?
The enjoyment is the aspect,
if it's sectioned off, even if it's within the boundaries, if it's sectioned off and purely used.
Actually, that's a cracking point. And there's another issue coming out of that. Brian's just made the point that if it was sectioned off and it was clear that it was separate from the main house, then you'd be dead as far as the exemption is concerned. And that actually is an important point. Thanks for that, Brian, because you also take the point that, and it's the classic one, if you and there's a good argument for never sectioning things off. If you've got a house that sits, just say, on a corner plot, and you think there's a possibility, and you're curtly or your land is like that, and you think there's a possibility of getting a building planning permission in there and making a new access and all the rest of it. If you're anticipating that you might get planning permission and you put that fence in there, as it were, to create in the planner's mind the idea of having a separate bit of the property, then as far as the PPR is concerned, that is death, because you're signalling that from the point you put the fence in that it's no longer part of the enjoyment bit. And Brian, I think that's a very powerful point. Just shows you how many points just come out of that. But that's the logical extension of that, and I think it's probably one of the powers of a session like this, is that we can start thinking sideways. Right, we better get a move on, folks. That's the first one. Okay. Right. Oh, is that yours? Oh, it was yours. Of course it's yours. Jeremy, absolutely brilliant, mate. Yeah. Does that solve it? Right, there you go. Excellent. Well done. Yes, of course, JN. Oh, wonderful. Fantastic. We'll put our bill in a little bit later, if that's okay. Could you all get your invoicing systems ready to go? Daphne.
I'm concerned about this putting a fence in, because if you make garden books, as people frequently do, that would actually do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is don't do garden
books. What I'm saying is that you need to be... Not in its greatest sense, because if you look very carefully at the TCGA, what it says is that we've got that you get it on the house, the gardens, and the grounds. There are three very distinct elements to that: house, gardens, and grounds. And the fact that it might be partitioned off, the fact that it might even be just across the road, because you get Old Village Gardens where they're physically separate from the main house, it doesn't matter. It's got to be part of, and the key word there, Karen, was enjoyment. It's the bit that you enjoy. But the minute but the problem is that when you have the little cottage in the big house gardens, and you put a hedge there because you don't want your gardener to be seen, as it were, from the big house, then that again is death as far as the PPR is concerned. There are loads and loads of cases about people that had, you know, the big house plus the little garden cottage where the gardener stroke housekeeper lived, and they partitioned it off and it was sort of just down the garden somewhere. And quite often the cases have shown that those will not qualify for the PPR. So it's quite important. Right, that's good. Number one down. Jeremy, happy bunny. Okay, on the same type of thing here, I've got... I won't identify the people unless they've actually want me to. Just so wave your flipper if this is one of yours. This is from Sue, and it's all about a disposal of property and capital gains liability. And I think the best way I can do this one is just to draw it, just to give you just an impression of it. So we've got a main residence here. A main residence. And then this person was gifted house number two. Gifted house number two. And it was left from his grand... It was given by his grandmother. None of this is particularly important. It's just... And it was valued at the time of £60,000. And it had a tenant in it. So it had a sitting tenant in. So he was gifted, I think it was just before a death, this house with a sitting tenant in. But this is the critical information. He wanted to renovate his main res, because it was getting a bit tired. And so he moved into house number two. And I'm going to use the words with enormous care here. What we've now got is actual occupation. And I'm using that straight out of the legislation. Actual occupation. And they also made an election. Are you clear that when we talk about a principal private residence, the word principal means that if you've got more than one, then you really ought to nominate which of those is your principal private residence. And if you don't, and a lot of people don't pick it up, then the revenue, HMRC as is entitled to determine on the facts whether you live there or not. So it's quite important to get this one right here. But they did make an election. So the election for this one to be, for house number two to be the PPR, just adds weight to him living in there. So I'll put a smiley face for that one. But we don't absolutely have to have it. And then he goes back, moves back. Nearly there. He moves back. And then he lets it again. And then his first wife, I just need to give you this last bit of information. His first wife dies. And then he remarries. After an interval of decency, I trust. He remarries. And then, and I better give you the dates here because there's a sub-issue. In February 12, he gifts 50% of the house to his new wife. And in April the 12th, I need to be very precise about this, they sell house number two. And do you agree from that point we've got two names on the deeds? Yeah, happy with that. We'll talk about that bit in just a second. But the question was, would you be able to help and tell me roughly how much CGT we've got to pay? They're selling it for 220K, and we've got that number there. So we've got 160 of gain, and the question very simply is, how do we deal with that gain? So let me just ask you on principle, forget about the numbers here, but how would you go about doing that? How would you go about doing that? What's that word that we brought up in the last one, which is quite important here? It's apportionment, isn't it? It's time-based apportionment, apportionment. Call it what you will. Do you agree we've got apportionment here? Yeah, Jeremy, can you see that okay at the back? I'll try and write a bit for...
Mike, did you put a date of
inheritance? Yes, it was 1989. Thanks, Jeremy. 1989. Right, OK, so do you agree that effectively what we've got, because we're selling this one, and do you agree we've had a period of actual occupation? Daphne, is there a question there?
Yes, it's the 12th of April,
both done on the same day. Thank you very much. Very intelligent question. They were both done on the same day. I'll come back and talk about that one in just a second. The dates of occupation were 2009. That's a great question. You're asking all the right questions. It was give or take 2009 to 2011. So give or take, we've got 2 years of actual occupation. Is that good news or bad news? That's good news, isn't it? Why? Why is it good news?
It reduces the gain.
It reduces the gain. Why? What does that period of actual occupation give you? It gives you the last 3 years tax-free. Do you remember the last 36 months rule? So that effectively says that here's my gain, that's the number of years I've owned it, and do you agree that because he actually occupied it, that critical concept of actual occupation, that will frank the last 3 years with what is called deemed occupation? Do you agree? Actual and deemed. We call it the 36-month rule, but it's effectively deeming that to be occupation by virtue of this. Does it matter how long that is? We've got 2 years. What was it? What if it had only been 2 weeks? Good news or bad news? He moved in because he wanted to renovate the main residence. And that ended up taking 2 years, and then he moved back afterwards. So he lived in it for 2 years. He actually occupied it. So is the length of time you occupy the second one, is that important? I think it is. I think you've got to have reasonable, objective evidence. So if they went round and knocked on the house next door and said, do you know Steedy, or that bloke with the old Land Rover who claims to live next door? And if they said, oh, yeah, no, we know him, funny hair, you know, old car, yeah, we know him, that's fine, that's the right reaction. But if they said, oh, no, never came once a year to mow the lawn, bad news. So if you've got actual occupation, it's got to be objectively seen to be actual occupation. So that's good. The fact that we backed it up with an election just adds weight to it. But that's not critical. Because if we were able to show on the facts that he had it, it's actual, end of. So we've got a 2-year actual occupation. We've now franked it. So we've got the last 3 years is covered. We've got this bit that's covered. What about the letting bits in between? Is there anything we can do with that? Or we just accept that we're going to pay the CGT on that? Lettings relief, absolutely. Let's just say that the bit in the middle here, I don't think I've got colour options on this. Have I got colour options? Oh, no, it just puts those in, doesn't it? Right, OK. God, scary. Right, OK, now I better walk away from that one. I like sticks in the sand. I ought to use that a little bit more. Gosh, how wonderful. The criticality of it is that we've got lettings relief, and it's a rather weird relief, and it's almost asked the question, why the hell have we got it there in the first place? But it was brought in at a time when the government was trying to encourage people to let. So if you went abroad to work, you know, you'd let your house and therefore make it available to the market. Because you weren't in it, you didn't have actual occupation, then that would give you a problem with your CGT. So they said, OK, it's a relief. But I always read this as being a subsidiary relief, and effectively it allows you to play with the bit that's left up to a maximum of, and it's a rather weird rule, there's a three-legged rule in there, but effectively up to a maximum of another £40,000. OK, one last thing then as we move on. What about this bit about gifting it to his second wife? And then we've got a year-end boundary, and then we've got a sale. So we have one name at that point. Do you agree? Two names on the deeds at that point. But they're not very far apart. Does that work? Is that effective? What if they changed the names on the deeds on April the 11th and sold them on April the 12th? No, Suze. That feels like avoidance, doesn't it? Absolutely. And I think...
Was it on the market in February?
Yes, it was, yeah. Yeah, it was on the market. So you didn't, yeah, but I prefer it to be done before they put it on the market, and I can see the way your head's going on that, I agree.
Is there a statutory amount of time?
No, that's a great question. Is there a statutory amount of time, is the question, between changing from one to two and then the sale? The short answer is no, there's not. There is no statutory thing. This is just one of these kind of grey amorphous things where you've got a fog in front of you, and there may be a monster inside it, and there may not be. But I always say to people, I'm sure you say the same, be cautious. Don't do the change on the 11th and sell on the 12th. That's, to me, that's death. They're just inviting them to say that it is artificial. And therefore, they would challenge it. Excuse me, coughing and spluttering here. Anyway, there you go. That's the second one. So that was Sue's.
Can I turn that
yep.
up on itself? Yep. Your main residence is house 2.
It was house 2 for that period.
Yeah. Your
main residence is house 1.
You are gifted house 2.
House 2 needs renovation.
You can live in it.
Before you can live in it. So the question is,
what's the gain if you then come to sell house 1?
Right. Well, the issue again is whether house 2 has ever become a residence. Because what you very often get here, and it's a subsidiary issue, is you get main residence in here, and then you get someone buys a buy-to-let. And of course the issue is, assuming that you bought it for 100 units and you're likely to sell it for 200 units in a good market, then these questions suddenly become quite important. Now, if it's just a normal buy-to-let and you're not doing anything with it, or it's just gifted to you and you have to do lots of renovation work here, then the issue probably is that, and then it's let, then the question is always, and we're coming back to that, is that capital or is that revenue? And do you take the point that if it's right at the beginning, before you let it, then there's a famous case called Law Shipping, which pulls it back into capital, even though it otherwise might be revenue, and that's the key thing. Now, we will come back and talk about that one, because there is that second issue of how far does Law Shipping actually run? And I've got another question from Stephen in Ipswich, which I'll talk about in just a second. But effectively, it's exactly the same issue. And people say, oh, look, I've got a gain on a buy-to-let. What can we do about it? And my answer is always, if you can live in it, then do so. But you've got to do that within kind of 2 years, because whenever you have a change in the total number of residences, you actually start a two-year clock ticking. And if you don't elect within the two-year period, the revenue determines it on facts. So all is not lost, but it just may not be the result you want. So it's exactly the same issue. Right, folks, let's move on.
Well, Can I just ask one quick one on
yep.
that one? Surely only he will get the last 3 years and the half, having gifted half to his new wife.
Oh, yes, yeah, absolutely. You've yeah. got to look at the apportionment quite carefully on that. So yeah. I was just looking for the principle there of actually covering it. But, yeah, no, that's absolutely fine. I mean, he's very firmly a high-rate taxpayer, and she's a basic-rate taxpayer, so we've got to think carefully about that. But it's all done on the time-apportioned basis on that. Right, folks, let's move on. Let's just try and find another one here. Okay, that's number two down. Henry, how are we doing for time here?
Nearly 20 past.
Okay, I need to start accelerating here then. Right, okay, I've got a number of questions on capital allowances. Always questions on capital allowances, aren't there? Now, one of these actually came... Well, I did cover... In fact, two of these I covered on the tax update series. So if you're on the tax update series, you can zizz for about the next 2 or 3 minutes before you, well, I'll wake you up again. But it's the difference between... You know, it's that old word, plant and machinery, isn't it? Plant and machinery, really difficult words. Machinery is relatively easy because it whizzes and bangs and it needs oiling and all that kind of stuff. And we know it. We sort of know it. Plant is much more amorphous. Plant is very difficult. And that's where all the problems occur. So if I put a miserable face in there, we know that all the tax cases are around whether something is plant or not. Do you remember things like canopies over petrol stations? And whether we work out whether it can actually, whether it's eligible for an allowance lot, is a really simple litmus test. And the litmus test, is it plant? Does it have a function? Does it do something? Or is it merely the setting in which it occurs? Function equals good, equals strong likelihood of allowances. Setting equals bad, equals miserable face. We can't get an allowance on it. So if you imagine one of your clients, say, had a pub, and they go and buy a gazebo to put in the garden so that the smokers can go and have a quick whiff in, and so they put that in the garden, what do you think? Is that going to qualify for an allowance? Yeah? Think that's going to qualify for an allowance? Yeah? Yeah? What if it was quite a permanent structure? What if it wasn't your average B&Q gazebo, but it was actually quite a sort of solid structure, sort of big wooden butch sort of a thing? What would be the deal there, do you think? Would that still qualify?
Yeah.
Yeah? Bob still wants that to qualify. What do you think? What are the problems? What's the difference? They could have a barbecue in it now and again, yeah? Okay, they could have a... Yeah, but it's mostly it's a smoker's sort of hovel. You know what I mean? All that kind of stuff. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because they all hunch up a bit when they do it, don't they? Right, okay. There's something intrinsically unhealthy about it. It sucks the goodness out of it. Right, okay. Enough of that. Let's get back to the business here. This is tax. This is sensible. Right, okay. So does it have a function? What does it do? What do we get out of this? And if it does something, then it's probably going to be plant. If it doesn't do anything, it's merely the setting, then that's bad news. And, of course, let's just have a look at some of those. Sort of pub, smokers... Did you notice I got the apostrophe in the right place there? I know, I'm sad. I know, I understand the rule on apostrophes, and I make sure that I make everyone else's life a misery if it's in the wrong place. Right, okay, pub smokers gazebo. But also, it's exactly the same thing about polytunnels, isn't it? Polytunnels and greenhouses. So when we get these, it's exactly the same question. Does it do something? What do you think the argument would be for the smoker's gazebo being doing something? Do you think we can get that? Or do we think the gazebo is actually just the setting and therefore it won't get an allowance because it doesn't do anything? And does it keep them dry? Is that good enough? Keeps them dry. Because remember the canopy over the petrol station? What was that for? It was to keep the punters dry. And yet it failed in the test because it was held to be the setting in which the trade happens and not with some kind of function. So if somebody said to me gazebo on there, I'd immediately be thinking, I'm worried about that one. Unless it's relatively easily movable. And if it's relatively easily movable, and indeed it does move... then along a spectrum of possibility, I think that's moving in the right direction. And I think that's quite an important point. And before we get resolution on that one, let's have a look at this one here too, because that's exactly the same argument there. Polytunnels and greenhouses. Do you think a basic greenhouse will actually be eligible for a capital allowance? Tim shaking his head.
Yeah.
What about, yes, yeah, think it would? Yeah? Same for a polytunnel? Because it does something? What does it do? Protects the plants? Yeah, absolutely. Do you remember the Scottish and Newcastle breweries? Say again.
It's doing the same as the gazebo.
It's doing the same as the gazebo. Well done, absolutely. Do you remember the famous Scottish and Newcastle breweries case where they did up all their pubs and they created a lovely ambience by having low lighting and all those kind of good things and plants and quite heavy wallpaper and pictures on the wall? The revenue was denied them allowances, saying it's just the setting. But they won in court because it created an ambiance. How about the argument that the greenhouses create an ambiance in which your lovely little plants can go and grow and be happy? Do you think that's going to work? I don't think it's going to work. I worry about these here. The only ones that I do consistently see get through are polytunnels, but only where they're movable polytunnels, where you just ram the ends into the ground. I'll take your points in just a second, folks. But, yes, I know there's a few bits coming up here. But generally speaking, I've managed to get them through, and I've talked around the AAT groups, and they've managed to get them through too, where they're just simply, you know, the sticks are poked into the ground. But ones that are cemented into the ground, they have an air of greater permanence. Now, one last point before I take your points back to me and your challenges is that if, however, you've got a greenhouse which has got a huge kind of delivery system and hydroponics and goodness knows what, and down where I come from in Kent, in that sort of lovely area of marshy, mystical land to the east of Canterbury, between Canterbury and the sea at Sandwich, there's UK's biggest greenhouse, Planet Thanet, Thanet Earth, call it what you will. But it produces something like a third of all the salad crops in the UK at the moment. And the point's dead simple. That is all grown hydroponically. In other words, it's water with nutrients, vitis. There's not a bit of earth in sight. I think it's a big software system. The software delivers it, water, nutrients. It's incredibly scientific. Now, what do you think? Would that qualify as plant? Yeah. Because it's got a very specific function, hasn't it? Does that include the glass? The basic shape? Yeah, it does, and that's the resolution on this. So I'll give you the resolution as I read that. Basically, you're in bad shape. The presumption is that none of these are going to qualify. However, you can push that one if it's shown that it's movable and indeed does move. If it does move, that's very helpful. Same with this one here. Greenhouse is generally bad news unless they're part of this hugely integrated system where everything does something, in which case the revenue say, yeah, it's just one big system, we accept that it is plant. Right, thoughts, Catherine, was there a point from you?
Yes, I was just going to say that if it's the point you're making about being movable, presumably if it is something that can be sold separately to the main core of the business,
yes,
then
like
it's
that.
Going to qualify.
Yeah, that's it's helpful. That's
so,
enormously
so your
helpful.
Smoker's gazebo, you know, speaking as
I
a
agree.
Smoker.
Yeah. It's I agree, that's enormously there. Helpful. Yeah, thank you. Tim, was there a point on you?
No, just confirm what I thought. I thought that the greenhouse had an automatic window opener and an irrigation system built in.
Yeah, irrigation, automatic window openers, I agree. That's great. Is there a question at the back, madam?
If you're growing crops in your polytunnels that
yep.
will not grow without a polytunnel,
yep.
surely that is...
No, I know. That's the standard argument. It's a great, great argument.
Because if you're in a gazebo and having a cigarette, you can still have a cigarette even if you're getting wet. But if the plant's not going to grow, they're just going to die if you take the polytunnel
no,
away.
No, absolutely. No,
it sounds...
I agree. I absolutely agree. But it's not logical. They simply say that it is the setting in which the trade occurs. And Pharaoh's heart is hardened and he will not let my people go. So you're in deep doo-doos on that one, sadly. But I agree, it defies logic. You think, wouldn't you just think that is that's an ambiance argument, if nothing else, but it will not prevail, sadly. Right, folks, how's that? Is that all right? Need to move on just a little bit. How are we doing for time, Henry?
25
past, that's good. Right, bit of uproar, bit of militancy on the floor. We like that. OK, I think, let's just carry on. I've got one about putting insulation. This is buy to lets. There are two angles here. There's some buy to let, and we do insulation, and that's cavity wall insulation plus loft. And the question is, what's all that for tax? And I guess the subsidiary question is, what difference would it make if it was for commercial property? So you've got your office, and you put the insulation across all of that. Does it make a difference? What do you think? Am I going to get any kind of tax relief on these? It's an improvement, yeah? Oh, yeah, that's absolutely. It's a business here. So that's a buy-to-let. Well, yeah, it's a buy-to-let business. It's an old Schedule A business, if you like. What now is known in Latoya as a UK letting business. Yeah.
John. Is there any insulation in the loft at the moment?
Very, very thin. It's a top-up. So it's virtually nothing. Yeah. What do you think? Do you think we're going to get tax relief? Is there any difference between these two boxes? Does it make a difference that one of them is domestic property and one of them is commercial property? Do you think that makes a difference?
Yeah.
You bet. Yeah, what's the difference? Do you remember the basic shape of it is that you can get capital allowances on anything, give or take, but not a cat's chance in hell of getting it on domestic property. The basic rule, remember, is that you never get capital allowances on items within domestic property. And that's quite an important rule there. We know that because... So I should just put that one down there if I can get this thing to
work. If you're nothing on a domestic property right now, they'll ring you up and say, you haven't taken advantage of your free grant for your loft insulation.
Yeah, that's another matter, Bob, and I'll come on to that in just a second. But no CAs in domestic, because it says so in Section 35... Capital Allowances Act 2001. So that's quite an important one there. So no CAs in domestic. It means that if you've got a buy-to-let portfolio, you can't get your allowances for capital and improvement under the Capital Allowances Act. It's just fair Bolton. You can get it if you had a portfolio of properties and you went out and bought vans to, service the properties. You're okay on the vans because they're not in the domestic property. So it's quite an important rule. So basically, commercial property, if we do that, that is okay for capital allowances. That's the first rule. So let's number those in order. Thermal insulation is okay. It's specifically targeted. But it's actually at the new rate. It's the special pool rate of 8%. So if I just put here special pool rate of 8%, you're all happy that it's gone down from 10 to 8 in the special pool from April. So 8% on that one. But you could put it under the AIA, yeah? Because your AIA does cover both the special rate pool and the other pool. Jeremy.
Mike.
Behind you, madam. Behind you.
Mike. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, my.
I'm not that mutton, Jeff, mate.
Mike, the insulation, is this a modernisation of insulation?
I think that was one of the questions here.
Insulation is much thicker, and you are talking about replacing the insulation in a buy-to-let house.
Yeah.
Old insulation or new, would it qualify under the same rules for replacing windows?
No. I'm going to stick my neck out on that one and say no. Can I make the distinction between the two things? And I'll come back to the windows bit. But as far as the insulation is concerned, I'm now ready to give you to just remind you of the other big fact here, and that is because we're never going to get capital allowances on anything on domestics. We're basically stuffed on this one here. We're good on that one, even though it's 8%, but it might be covered by the AIA. But on this one here, unquestionably, what we're going to have to do is to lean on something else. And that something else is the LESA, the Landlord's Energy Saving Allowance. Do you remember that one? If you want background information on that, it's in iToya. This can be for both, incidentally, this could be for both where you've got corporate landlords or individual landlords. But what it effectively does is it allows you to spend up to, do you remember the number, £1,500 per property. £1,500 per property. If you want some background information on the LESA, there's one of my favourite websites is directgov.uk.
And that's got an awful lot of good information about the lease. So just go into directgov.uk and just hit Lisa, and you'll come up with some good stuff on that. That's really worth having. And what I like about directgov is it's a very straightforward, written in plain English website, and I use it quite a lot on things like benefits as well. You know, somebody says, "Oh, is disability living allowance?" which I get, and I always forget which is taxable and which is not, but I just go straight on to DirectGov, and it just saves me hours and hours going through the revenues website. Because let's face it, if you go on the search engine on HMRC's website, you lose the will to live after about 3 minutes. Is it? There's nobody from HMRC here, is there? Or the Treasury. Mind you, we do teach quite a lot of revenue officers, and they all say, yeah, it's rubbish, and they use Google. So their own search engine in-house is Google, which I always find vastly amusing. Anyway, so there you go. Henry, quick time check, please.
9:32.
Right, we've got about 15 minutes to run. I need to crack on. Right, what I'm going to do then is to do the other one, which is the classic one on pre-let. I said I'd come back to this, property repairs. And I had somebody, this is Stephen from Ipswich, who moaned at me. That he said, this is all about, what happened was we got buy-to-let, and then we had and I quote here, a vastly improved kitchen. And then they started letting it. So the question very simply is the cost, let's just say that that's £25,000, and it was a B&Q job before, seen its time, and now they're upgrading it. Question for you. Will I get tax relief on that £25,000? When will I get it? When you sell it, absolutely. That's critical. So do you agree it's capital? It's capital. Now, what he was moaning about was that, he said, and I quote here, what got really annoying was my clients ripped out the kitchen and put a vastly improved kitchen, did loads of stuff, which I said was capital, and I agree with him, and they couldn't claim. So they phoned the revenue, and the revenue told them it was all okay, and my clients even got it in writing for them, so we claimed it. I know, Tim, that was my reaction too. Let's draw the strings out, be absolutely clear here. Do you agree that in an earlier sketch we referred to the massively important case of Law Shipping? Do you remember Law Shipping? What Law Shipping is all about, and it's just one of the top 10 tax cases of all time, but dead simple. This is where new owners bought a ship that had sunk on its moorings in a harbour. And because it had sunk, and there was just the mast sticking up above the water, pretty obviously they couldn't use it, but they thought it was actually a steal at the price. Not surprising, it was underwater. And they plugged it, raised it, and then repaired it, and then traded it. So the point was that they couldn't actually trade it without doing this expenditure. Do you take that as a point? And that turns out to be massively important in the context of Law Shipping. Because if you can't... Just a second, John. If you can't physically trade it without the work, then there is no question in my mind that that is capital. Absolutely no question in my mind whatsoever. And also, the vastly improved kitchen is not a like-for-like replacement. Do you agree? And that, therefore, pulls it back into capital. And I think they gave the revenue the wrong information personally, and the revenue just said, yes, you know, providing it's like-for-like. And then they phone you up in triumph and say, I got it through, they've agreed with me. And you're secretly thinking, well, it just makes me look an idiot, doesn't it? But I know I'm right. And if they ever look at it in detail, why would we prove to be right? So what do we need? If it wasn't a vastly improved kitchen and it was like for like, would that change things? Yes, I think it would change. A few nods around the room. I think it would change things. Because here's the point. You don't need to do it before you start trading. And the revenue's position on that is that, go on then, we will let it, but only on the basis that it could have been let. Which is why I always say that if you've got work to do, make sure you get somebody in there, even if it's for a couple of weeks before. Tim's nodding madly. I know you've had one of these in practice, haven't you? Tim, do you just want to share that one with us, just as we...
Yeah, I have a client built a new property, which was shops, offices and a flat, borrowed a considerable amount of money. Fairly early on, he didn't let it till the whole building was completed, and I inherited.
inherited this case after the event. They put in a claim when they started letting for all the accrued interest on the loans, and the revenue said, sorry, because the letting hadn't started, the trade didn't exist. No tax relief on the loan interest, and also you cannot add that loan interest to the capital cost either, so it completely evaporated.
Yeah.
Very expensive mistake.
Yeah.
And what added insult, the inspector said to him, oh, if you'd have put somebody in the flat for 2 weeks at the beginning, you could have had the lot.
Yeah. That's a very, very powerful point, that. It just shows that when you've got this type of situation, you've got to try and get your clients to talk to you so that you can give proper advice. I think that what the revenue gave this person, Stephen's client, is completely wrong because of the vast improvement there. But if it was like for like, it would have been fine. Anyway, Henry, how are we doing for time?
About 5 minutes.
About 5 minutes. OK, in which case I need to rush on then. We've done that. Yes, I better just quickly tell you where we are on... This is somebody asking about divis and NIC. Classic one here. This is a story that's going to rumble for the whole of this year. But effectively, there are two important cases that you need to get your heads around. This is somebody who's asking about, is it okay still to go the sort of secondary threshold salary followed by the top-up in dividends up to the higher rate threshold? Do you agree a brutally efficient method of extracting funds? There are two cases that you need to know about. One's called PA Holdings, and the other one is called Manthorpe Building Services. And they both worry me, and that's not very often I get worried. So what's going on here? These are effectively what I will call, and I'm going to use my words here, but with great care, they are artificial, abusive planning schemes. My words, artificial, abusive planning schemes. And effectively what they're trying to do, and I'll just give you an example in the case of PA, that they had their normal employees, they were going to pay them a bonus. Bonus equals earnings equals NIC, all the rest of it. And they said, why don't we restructure this and create a new class of shares? Do you agree? Alphabet shares? No rights attached to them whatsoever, and we'll pay them all through divis. Divis equals good equals no NIC. That's the effective message. And it went all the way up to the Court of Appeal, and they struck it down on the basis that it was completely and utterly artificial. That it was earnings. And the taxpayer tried to argue that if something's a divis, it cannot be earnings because of what's called the tiebreaker rules, and the court threw it out. They said this is nakedly earnings. Do you agree with me how important that word earnings is? And it's got different meanings for income tax than it is for NIC. They're very similar, but they come from very different parts of the tax canon. So that's PA Holdings. And Manthorpe is equally naked. Manthorpe is all about husband and wife company, where they created a new company with a new class of shares, and they said, this is how we're going to pay ourselves this year, and this is how we're going to pay ourselves going forward. And they had this incredibly artificial thing of these alphabet shares. And again, the revenue went for them. The court, the first and upper tier tribunal, agreed with the revenue. So what that comes to is that they said, it's earnings. Whatever it is, it's earnings. And so as we come to the end of this session, I just want to make the point, you know, how far does that go down into the SME part of the spectrum, which we advise often on in terms of dividends and, you know, whether it works? Because a lot of us will be advising, and in fact have the structures ourselves, we take out a small salary and we can talk about the level of that, plus the top-up's going to be in divis. Is that still going to be okay? Well, there's been a lot of talk about this one here. The question is, what sort of level of remuneration? Is it remuneration? If you've got the word remuneration, you've got about 2 minutes to run now, Henry. If it is remuneration, then, and it's remuneration for the future, then the chances are the revenue are going to say, no matter what it is, it's earnings equals nickable, even if you describe it as a dividend. And that's the bit that worries me. So does it have to be reasonable? Are we heading for, and this is the bit that I don't know, this is why it worries me slightly, whereas if you've got dividend extraction from a company where there's this time next year we'll be having to say, because of new stuff in FB 2013, that actually what we've got here will be the requirement to pay a reasonable remuneration before you take your divis. Now, I don't know where we are on that, so that's very much a watch this space. But what it does say to me is that as we stand now, for the first time, I'm feeling more cautious about these kind of structures than I have been for a long time. So I'm not crying wolf on it. I'm simply saying a healthy note of caution here. If people are talking about incorporation, I think we need to be able to say to them that there may be problems on the horizon in respect of extraction. Right, Henry, I think I've come...
It would defeat the whole business of dividends, I might.
It would. And that's...
When
that. That
is,
yeah.
If you make a profit and you pay a dividend, there's nothing wrong with that.
No, no, there is... No.
HMRC can't argue with it.
Well, they can if they think it's just basically disguised remuneration. And that's the issue. So it is an area that I'm concerned about. And I think...
they argue that way? If you say, look, I pay myself...
Bob, sorry, can you come and talk to me after that? Because I think we're now running out of time. Right, folks, I think I need to turn into a pumpkin, so I'm going to hand back to Henry.
Thanks, Mike. It's not often I'm in awe of somebody, but for Mike to come up and do what he's just done, as he has done, I really don't know how he does that. So well done, Mike. Fantastic. Okay, hope you all enjoyed that. Just to explain now what's going to happen now, the delegates from Stream 2 will be joining us in this room for the keynote speech coming up shortly from David Evans, the UK senior partner of Mazars, who are the main sponsors. So if you can just all sit tight for a couple of minutes while everybody moves in, and then we're due to start again in about 5 minutes. Okay, see you all soon.